I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Amid all the primary election news last week, a more disturbing story about a Florida politician stood out. The arrest of Palm Beach County Clerk of Court and Comptroller Mike Caruso on child sexual abuse charges. Caruso, a former state representative and prominent ally of Governor Ron DeSantis, denies it. But DeSantis has suspended Caruso from the Palm Beach County post the governor himself appointed him to. As shocking as the abuse allegation, though, is the realization that red flags were raised about Caruso's alleged pedophilia in the past, but were seemingly ignored. Should the governor have been aware of it? And why did his office release the unredacted Caruso arrest affidavit that identifies the child victim? WLRN will not identify the child. There are 42 million child sexual abuse survivors in the U.S., and especially in Florida, home to the late serial abuser Jeffrey Epstein, this case is a reminder that we have to keep confronting the issue of prevention and privacy. To share your thoughts, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is former Florida State Senator Lauren Book, herself a child sexual abuse survivor, who is founder of the prevention nonprofit Lauren's Kids. Senator, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us is Dr. Maureen C. Kenney. She's a psychology professor at Florida International University and an expert on child sexual abuse prevention. Dr. Kenney, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing attention to this important issue.
Senator Book, I want to start off here with that aspect of the Mike Caruso case that speaks so directly to child sexual abuse prevention. That is the fact that there were warnings about him on public record. But as a South Florida Sun Sentinel article headline this week puts it, those child sex abuse allegations went nowhere. And it happens all the time. As a survivor yourself, Senator, how representative is Caruso's case of that problem, which seems so particularly key to child sexual abuse prevention?
Thank you, Tim. And you're right. This is something that we see quite a bit as we walk the state of Florida and we do the work that we do every day. We see time and time and time again cases involving custody, and divorce cases in particular, where children are disclosing abuse. They're often put under the rug. People don't want to talk about it. The department walks away from it. And when children are desperately in need of help, this is a time where we need to lean in and not lean away. And it's something we see every day. Literally this week, I had a call with a mother in Gainesville whose daughter was sexually abused by her father, biological. He's currently sitting in jail, about to serve a very lengthy prison sentence, 5 life sentences, in fact, and the judge refused to terminate parental rights. And so we're helping that mother be able to do that. These things are happening every single day.
Right.
And it underscores everything that you're talking about.
That Sun Sentinel article I alluded to points to what it calls a systemic blind spot, that in cases like Caruso's earlier divorce, for example, the chance that a parent or child will be believed when the report, when sexual abuse is reported is, quote, drastically reduced. What's got to change from that legal systemic viewpoint in your mind, Senator?
I think that we can't just look away when it's dealing with a custody situation. Certainly something that the department needs to look at. Again, there are lots of people in a child's life that may have made a report. I'm not aware of all of those as it relates specifically to that case. But when the department receives multiple calls about an individual, I would hope, and I've been told up until now, that the department does go back and look, because maybe one report of an instance doesn't rise to the level of an investigation, but multiple red flags may.
Yeah.
And clearly the system isn't working.
Dr. Kenny, one of the challenges, however, is the reality that child sexual abusers and pedophiles are so often master manipulators, not just of the young victims, but of the adults around them. When you look at the allegations against Mike Caruso, how was he able, I mean, he was able to so often get alone with the victim, for example, such as in a cruise ship. What are the red flags you see that every one of us should be on the lookout for?
Right. I mean, I think his case is a great example of somebody grooming not only the child, but the family, right? And they've built a relationship that puts them, you know, below suspicion, right? They're flying below the radar.
Right.
And I think the onus is really on parents, right? It's not on children. We know very few children disclose sexual abuse. The onus is on parents to monitor their children, monitor the people they spend time with, increase their communication with their child, right? And to some degree, have a level of suspicion about people that want to spend time alone with their children, right? And I don't think that that happened in this case, or he wouldn't have had the opportunity to be alone.
Aside from that, you know, that cruise ship incident, for example, that mm-hmm. that we've read about, what when you look at the case, what are some of the specific red flags that, you know, of the manipulation that he was able to engineer, let's say, that stand out for you?
Well, I mean, I think you're talking about an adult offender and a child, right? So an adult is always going to be able to better manipulate a child, and we can't expect the child to be sensitive to those manipulations. Does that make sense? You know,
yeah. mm-hmm.
they're very easily sort of tricked and fooled by that. You
oh,
know,
sure.
I did a study where we asked children, we described people as a good person and a bad person. And in both scenarios, we said, would you let them touch you? And when they were described as a bad person, they said no. And when they were described as a good person, they said yes. So yeah. it's, you know, they're not attuned. They can't, you know, discern who's a bad person, who's not. This is somebody that's known to their family. They spend time with. Their parents have sort of vetted this person. They're not going to be able to protect themselves against such an offender.
Right. Senator Book, I mentioned at the outset the estimate from the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse that there are 42 million such survivors in the USA today. How serious, though, is the problem in Florida? And I ask in no small part because Florida last year dropped from 9th to 21st in the World Childhood Foundation USA evaluation of state laws and responses to child sexual abuse.
This is an issue that is ever present. I think with the proliferation of the internet, children having access to the internet, predators who seek to harm our children, these things are happening every single day. It's widespread, it's very real. And as Dr. Kenny said, it's becoming more and more difficult when we don't educate our children on ways to identify safe and unsafe individuals and how to access help. And when children do try to access help, when we're not able and when the system around those children fail, it's harder and harder to come forward. Again, Mike Caruso is a person who was a exemplary, so people would believe, member of society and community. He was a baseball coach, a Little League baseball coach, positioning himself to vulnerable youth. There is an MO that predators and offenders look at, and it's what we need to do to educate children and then have a system set up for when they do disclose, when something does happen,
right.
that it's there to help them.
Well, not only that, he was one of the most vocal advocates in Tallahassee for creating legislation that would make it possible to for convicted child sexual abuse perpetrators to face the death penalty, no?
Yes. And when you read, and I know that we're not going to go in, and we may go into the arrest affidavit, you know, it's interesting to look into the mind of individuals like this who, you know, it's not me, it's thee. You know, in one of those points, he said, I couldn't possibly be a sexual deviant because I'm attracted to women. It is a little insane, not a little, it's very insane.
Uh-huh.
And it is one of those things where they believe that they can't be caught. The fact that he didn't remove himself from the ballot and people will have an opportunity to vote for this individual
right.
come November, regardless of whatever side of the aisle you're on, this speaks to, I believe, the type of perpetrator allegedly that this individual is.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kenny, is the public, especially the public in Florida, adequately educated and informed, in your opinion, about how to detect the warning signs that a child is being sexually abused? I think this is a good opportunity here to remind people what to be aware of and how to report what they are aware of, if you could, for us.
Sure. I want to answer that in two parts. One, no, I don't think the public in general is adequately educated. With the programming that I've done with parents, they never believe that it could be somebody known to them, right? And we know that that's who the offenders are. So our first step is educating the parents to say, you're looking in the wrong places, right? It's not the white van that pulls up to the street, right? It's the people that have access. And that's how people are able to manipulate children, as they gain access to their children. So I find that most people don't know that it's going to be somebody known to them. They think it's going to be a stranger. Mm-hmm. I remember when there was a baseball coach in my son's league who was arrested on charges of sodomy, and everybody said, can you believe that? And I said, yeah, I can believe it, right? So I don't think people know about that. And I don't think that people spend enough time talking to their children about all types of safety, right? Yeah. Parents will teach their kids to not touch the stove or to stay away from the water and things like that, but they never transition to personal safety, right? Giving children the proper names of their genitals so they can disclose. However, I think it's really important to say that we're talking about identifying signs after a child has been sexually abused. I'd like us to get to the point where we have less to identify, right? We need to be creating in this society less pedophiles, less offenders, right? And no one ever talks about that. It's too late once a child's been abused. We can get them intervention. I work with these people in my practice, sure, but we want to stop it earlier than that.
That's a good point. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with former State Senator Lauren Book and FIU psychology professor Maureen Kenny about the Mike Caruso child sexual abuse arrest and the larger nagging questions it has raised here again about prevention and privacy. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Senator Book, I want to turn to the other disturbing issue raised by the Caruso case, and that's victim privacy, which is also a factor in prevention. What in the world was Governor DeSantis's office thinking last week when it released that unredacted affidavit of Caruso's arrest that effectively identified the abuse victim? As I said at the outset, the South Florida Roundup is not going to identify who the child is. And fortunately, the only thing that was redacted was the child's name. But how much harm was done by this?
This is devastating, to be quite frank. It's a clear violation of Marcy's Law, which the people of the state of Florida voted for. We believe that victims have a right to privacy. I believe that the careless and, I mean, almost border criminal actions of this administration in releasing this affidavit in the way that they did was horrific. But I would suggest to you that it is not just a problem here. This is a widespread issue. Mm-hmm. Just today alone, I got an email from an advocate from a different place in the state where they got a quote redacted police affidavit similar to this with simply the name removed. They called the clerk's office and said, well, unless the state attorney's office doesn't tell us to redact further, we don't. That's because there was never implementing language surrounding Marcy's Law in the state. And that's something, when I do go back to the legislature, that I am going to change.
Okay, that's a great point. I don't think a lot of people realize there was that shortcoming in Marcy's Law. Dr. Kenny, I wanted to put the same question to you. When a sexual abuse victim is effectively outed in such an insensitively public way, what does it do to dissuade victims or their adult defenders to come forward in the future? And again, that would seem to put more obstacles to child sexual abuse prevention in the future, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's outrageous. And, we hopefully are moving towards more trauma-informed care of victims, right? To release the name of a child, you know, of a minor who has been a victim of a sexual crime like this is bordering unethical and insensitive. But sure, when I'm working with children who have been abused and there's potential legal action, it makes parents question it, right? Because of the nature in which the children are treated throughout the process. And this is one example. So, You know, we know from the evidence that trauma-informed care, you know, approaching people with sensitivity, giving them time to come forth on their own is the best way towards recovery. So this will likely, you know, I can't predict the future, but impede the recovery of this youth as well.
Yeah. And we should just clarify, they did not release the child's name, but they released enough details, identifying information you wouldn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out
exactly.
I read
former senator's statement about, you know, the identifying information about her at the time. So you know, it's you don't have to give the name, but when you give enough information and people involved can tell it's outrageous. You know,
Senator Book, while we're on the subject of the actions of Governor DeSantis's office in this case, it also raises the question of how aware the governor himself should have been about the admittedly public warnings that were out there when he and Caruso were close political allies. Now, this is not a Republican or Democratic problem, of course. This is not a partisan issue. But should we be vetting public officials for this kind of behavior precisely because, as we discussed before, the system does seem prone to give them a pass?
Absolutely. And the vetting would not have been hard. These were documents that local news outlets were able to get and receive and have very easily. And I'm talking about several domestic violence calls out to the home with his former spouse that were very easily available. The vetting was not there because, hey, it's a friend of mine. It's going to be okay. We don't need to look into it. And I would speak again to something that Dr. Kenny said. At the end of the day, a predator and offender offends as many as 117 children before they're caught. We know there are more. We also know that a predator and offender, that children are abused by someone they know, love, and trust 90% of the time. This is an individual who had access to children, who had a clear pattern of abuse. This was a huge, huge red flag that should have been caught. And at the end of the day, this blunder, this terrible lapse in judgment, this borderline criminal action, in my opinion, violation of the Constitution of the state of Florida, further serves as a chilling effect for other victims. Because let's be clear, there are other victims of this individual who will not come forward, because why would they?
Right.
Why
for sure.
would
yeah.
they?
Dr. Kenny, we only have about a minute left here in the segment, but we, of course, have Senator Book with us, and her organization, Lawrence Kids, is a prominent resource and refuge for child sexual abuse victims and survivors. But what other important resources do you want the public to be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't have as many resources as we should in this area, right? But I think that we have to encourage parents to increase their communication with their children. And when it's around a topic like sexual abuse, that's very difficult for parents, right? When I work with parents, I say, I don't want to talk about sex. You know, there's immediately a sort of like taboo about it. But what I try to get parents to do is understand that you're talking about, you know, their bodies, you're opening up communication. You know, one of the things we found when we work with parents and young children is the more the parents talk, the more the children are open about everything, right? Yeah. Not just, you know, they just increases that. There's a number of books that they can use, you know, that can talk about body safety, but I want to be clear that we don't want to put the onus just on children.
Right?
Parents need to take, you know, monitor who's spending time with their children, who's being alone with them. You know, if somebody wants to spend more time with my kids than I do, I'm suspicious of that individual, right? So, you know, really the biggest thing that parents have to do, you know, is be on the lookout and things like, you know, background screening, that doesn't work. Jerry Sandusky would have passed a background screening, you know, that doesn't pick. There's metadata on how background screening doesn't work.
Well,
people need to screen people more thoroughly, and there could be questions that can be asked that can sort of indicate this sort of behavior.
Good, helpful points, all. Dr. Maureen C. Kenny is a psychology professor at Florida International University. Thank you, Dr. Kenny.
Most welcome.
Former State Senator Lauren Book is the founder of Lauren's Kids. Thank you, Lauren Book. Senator Book, we appreciate it. Still to come, the animal house problem at a Brickell condo complex and other vacation rental properties here. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We just want to say at the outset of this segment that we're not out to demonize Airbnb and the whole vacation rental property thing that's so popular here and in around the world today, but like anything, it needs to be called out if it gets out of hand. And right now, the actual residents of a large Miami condo complex known as the Club at Brickell Bay say the never-ending and apparently illegal Airbnb Bacchanal at their building isn't just out of hand, it's become Animal House. About 85% of the 643 units at the club are Airbnbs, and the, shall we say, disturbing of the peace by their itinerant and party-hardy occupants has gotten so bad, the city of Miami recently ordered the complex to halt the short-term rentals. But the condo board there, all of whose members work in the short-term rental business and don't even live in the building, has all but told the city to get lost. And the ban plays on. Meanwhile, other residential high-rises across Miami and South Florida have become chaotic Airbnb party zones that turn condo life into spring break hotels. Is this something you've experienced here? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is veteran Miami Herald reporter Linda Robertson, whose reporting exposed this Miami mess, just as she's cast a spotlight on so many others over the years. Linda, how are you?
Hi. Nice to be with you, Tim.
How did you first hear about this controversy at the club at Brickell Bay? And remind us exactly where this condo complex is and how big it is.
So I first heard about it from a resident who lived there, and they felt like they were at the end of their rope. So they thought maybe having this exposed in the media might help them with their attempts to clean up the mess. And this is a 43-story 643-unit condo building at 1200 Brickell Bay Drive. It was built in 2004, and it's one of the largest condos in Miami.
And that's a pretty heavily popular, you know, kind of a congested area of the city, no?
Yes. And they're right across the street from them. Ken Griffin is building his new Citadel headquarters, which is going to be a 52-story building right on the water.
Okay, but about to become more congested then.
Yes.
All right. So this is a fairly large condo complex then, as condo complexes go in South Florida, no?
Yes. It's one of the largest in Miami.
So as I said, from your reporting, 85% of the units there appear to be Airbnb style, or Airbnb, I should say, short-term rental units. So if it's illegal to turn condo units at this complex into those short-term rentals, as the residents who actually live there assert, and the city of Miami seems to assert, how did this problem get to the point where 85% of the units are now used for that short-term rental purpose? What broke down here?
So originally the building was just a normal condo building. And over the years, people would buy units and rent them out by the year or maybe by the month. But during COVID, when there was this huge influx of people who were looking for short-term places to stay, the president of the board at that time saw an opportunity to convert it into more of a, the building would be more concentrated with short-term rentals, which is under 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you can make a lot more money if you're renting by the night than if you're renting by the month or by the year.
Right.
So this president basically encouraged all the people who owned investment units for investment income to convert them into short-term rentals and not long-term.
I see.
And then it was advertised by real estate agents as a condo that had no rental restrictions and an investor's dream. So
yeah,
this was a place that you could buy into and you could rent your unit as you please.
But again, that legality issue, the condo board there, which as I mentioned is obviously pro-Airbnb, it asserts that Miami zoning regulations do allow short-term rental at this complex, no?
Yes, but it's very complicated. And just because you have the zoning doesn't mean you have the proper approval to use your building as a hotel, as a condo hotel, kind of a hybrid classification. So they do not have a certificate of use other than multifamily residential.
Okay.
And they never really acquired one, and the city just kind of never paid attention, you know, just indifference, neglect, whatever. They let this proliferate and fester and didn't do anything about it, and now it's basically a de facto hotel.
Now, either way,
that old president, by the way, he installed a hotel reservation system in the office called GraceSoft, and it's software that hotels use.
All right. Not even trying to hide it there.
Yeah.
Either way, the big issue here is the rowdiness of the Airbnb renters who come in and out of this condo complex, like, as you've reported, Animal House, Spring Breakers. What is some of the most egregious behavior that residents there shared with you for these articles?
Well, the building has gotten a certain reputation, and so they've seen people carrying guns. They've seen people wearing ankle monitors. They have seen all kinds of stuff going on the balconies, including people shooting, you know, sex videos, porn videos, people having sex on the balconies.
Yeah, I saw some of the pictures of the articles. The dress code that some of these guests use isn't exactly shy.
No. So the people sitting in the lobby in thongs, barefoot, you know, bikinis, lots of shirtless men coming in and out. So they just, you know, they use it as a hotel, and they don't care because they see it advertised as an Airbnb. And I'm sure a lot of the people who visit don't even realize that there are people living there full time.
That's a good point. How did the condo board there respond, though, when you confronted them with these complaints that you were hearing? Just as important, I guess, what does Airbnb as a corporation have to say about the accusation that its business turns residential buildings into frat parties?
Well, two different things. The boards defend this kind of activity by saying that it's making money for the investors, and it's making the condo units more appealing for sales, because when you market it as no rental restrictions, it's more attractive to buyers. So their argument is that it increases property values. The residents would argue that it decreases property
values. Right, that was going to be one of my questions to you later. About
So, yeah, it's like a debate. And it probably depends on the building. And then Airbnb's standard defense is that they run a business that helps out people who have extra space and are looking for a little extra income, but that sort of belies the fact that Airbnb is no longer a mom-and-pop business. It's no longer
to say the least,
an air mattress in the living room, which is how it started.
Yeah,
It's an industry now. It's a $135 billion industry.
Oof.
And many cities around the world there's a huge backlash against it because it has just grown so big that it has taken over the center of many cities and displaced the people who live there.
So as a result, the city of Miami told the club at Brickell Bay to essentially cease and desist any new short-term rental bookings of these condo units. Needless to say, the condo board, the HOA there, hasn't exactly bowed to their wishes, right? Where do things stand, Linda? And if the city wants to get tough at this point, what can it really do?
Yeah, so the city, following our articles, sent a cease and desist order on August 11th. And Assistant City Manager Barbie Hernandez said, you must cease all short-term vacation rentals immediately. That was August 11th. And you must contact me within 10 days. This was to the board.
Right.
So the board, on the 10th day, the board wrote her a letter saying, we would like 90 days to examine, and then they made a huge list of public records. We would like to acquire these public records, everything about from zoning laws to police complaints at the building. And we need 90 days. And we're hiring a law firm that specializes
right.
in land use and zoning issues.
Uh-huh.
A law firm that you will see at every city commission meeting.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they work for developers. So as far as we know, they have been granted the 90 days, but we haven't heard one way or the other whether the city has refused the 90 days or granted it. But
right.
the fact that they haven't refused it would lead me to think that they're giving them the 90 days.
Okay.
So that kicks the can down the road another 3 months.
Yep.
And in the meantime, yep. none of the short-term rentals have ceased that we could find.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Linda Robertson about the Airbnb party problem the residents of a Miami condo complex are facing, and folks in other South Florida residential high-rises as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, again, Linda, I just want to clarify that, you know, beyond the constant animal house rowdiness, et cetera, you were pointing out that the board argues that this actually enhances the property value of condos in this building. But is that what the condo owners themselves were telling you? I mean, I would think that they would be of the opinion that, no, this decreases my value. What is the reality there?
So as far as we could tell, I think the owners are correct because they feel they've compared, you know, the price per square foot with comparable condos in the area, and they would get less. And they feel somewhat trapped there because they wouldn't be able to sell for the amount that they would expect. I think it depends on what you want to buy for. Like, if you want to buy to live there, it probably would be very unattractive and you wouldn't get those buyers.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to buy it as an investment property, you want, you know, an extra 50 to 90K a year, and you want the headache of, you know, running an Airbnb, then it would be attractive to you.
Right. If you want to be the Airbnb short-term rental condo owner, right?
Right.
But if you want to just live there, maybe raise a family there, you know, having, as I said, Animal House down the hall is not really going to raise your property value, no?
No, no. So I think it depends on what kind of buyer you are.
Yeah. Now, and this is not just a problem at the club at Brickell Bay, is it? I mean, complaints about the proliferation of short-term Airbnb rental units have arisen at other residential condo high-rises around Miami and South Florida, no?
Yes, all over South Florida. Different cities have taken different stances. Miami Beach was famous for cracking down some years ago. They had these $20,000 fines, and they had basically a strike force that would go around and kick people out of short-term rentals. And so a lot of that business migrated to Brickell.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that Miami Beach still doesn't have a problem. I mean, there's a lot of stealth Airbnbs operating all over the place. And these cities can't necessarily keep up with the problem. I mean, they have these code compliance departments that are dealing with, you know, somewhat, you could argue, more serious types of problems than blight.
Mm-hmm.
But in other cities around the world and around the United States, they've taken a very targeted approach to cracking down. Let me give you an example. New York City has a department solely dedicated to policing short-term rentals. And they have a local law 18 there
mm-hmm.
that is specifically designed to restrict how you can rent out your extra room or your apartment.
Is there talk of Miami adopting those kinds of ordinances?
Well, I mean, that's kind of, I think what we were hoping with these articles was to maybe raise the discussion to that level. Like, let's see what other cities are doing that's been effective.
Yeah,
and copy them, you know, and how are they able to do it? San Francisco, Barcelona, Berlin, all these cities have found ways to crack down, and they feel that the reason is that it raises rents in neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
And it changes the character of communities.
Yeah. No, definitely. Yeah. No, we'll see what comes of that then. Linda Robertson is a reporter for the Miami Herald. Linda, many thanks as always, and congrats on the great reporting as always.
Thanks, Tim. Good to talk to you.
Still to come, the TPS crisis for Haitians has created a crisis for home health care. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. This summer, the Trump administration canceled the Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, for some 350,000 Haitians in the U.S., making them subject now to deportation. It also strips them of their authorization to work in the U.S. And when you consider that about half of the Haitians who've lost their TPS are in South Florida, we were bound to see an economic effect here, especially in vital local industries like home health care, where Haitian workers have become talented and reliable fixtures. Well, that effect has come much sooner than later. According to the Wall Street Journal, some home health care agencies have already shut down since Haitian TPS ended last month. Nursing homes, restaurants, hotels, retailers, airport contractors. Many are scrambling to fill staffing shortages now as Haitian TPS holders either are let go or have quit so as not to expose themselves to federal immigration authorities. Have you noticed this sudden home health care crisis and other business effects here caused by the Haitian TPS crisis? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Denise Belleville, Executive Director of the Home Care Association of Florida. Denise, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And also from the HCAF, we are joined by its Senior Director of Policy, Advocacy, and Communications, Kyle Simon. Kyle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Denise Belleville, remind us what a large presence Haitian workers are in the home care sector here in Florida. They are, in fact, the largest national group of workers in that sector, right?
You know, what we have for data and statistics, as you mentioned, you know, 150,000 Haitian TPS immigrants are, you know, located in Florida. And what we understand is about 113,000 work in the healthcare industry, but I don't have a specific number to how many actually work in home healthcare.
I'm just alluding to the Wall Street Journal again. Haitians, they say, account for about 28% of the state's direct care or home care, the largest number of any national group, and that's what I was alluding to.
Yes.
So the presence is substantial, no?
Oh, absolutely, and certainly there are agencies who have created their niche to be providers for that particular individual, that person who came from Haiti, who speaks only Haitian Creole, who is looking for care by a caregiver who can abide by the customs, the language, you know, fill in for family members that might not be present.
But I've spoken with Haitian home health care workers here in South Florida, and they take care of a much broader range of clients than just Haitians. I mean, I remember speaking with one earlier this year who was very proud of the fact that she had been the home health care provider for a World War II hero.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, we've certainly heard those stories. I think most of what our providers are reaching out to let us know is the volume of their caregivers that have been caught up in the TPS termination clause.
Kyle Simon, given that importance of the Haitian workforce to an industry that you don't need to be a genius to figure out is a vital one in a retirement state like Florida, what sort of lobbying have organizations like yours done to get the Trump administration to reconsider the cancellation of temporary protected status or TPS for Haitians?
HCAF reached out to our congressional delegation, all 30 members, back in January, sounding the alarm on the impending expiration of the TPS. Our partners at the Florida Healthcare Association, which represents the senior care facilities, also sent a letter to Senators Moody and to the Trump administration just last month, I believe, raising concerns about this too, being that As Denise mentioned, immigrants represent 1 in 3 workers in home care settings, patients included, and 21% of workers in nursing homes. So, with Florida already having the nation's smallest home care workforce relative to our senior population, losing these experienced caregivers really comes down to fewer available services for older adults, people with disabilities, medically complex children, and families.
Was there a receptiveness to the argument that you were making of the effect that this could have on Florida?
Unfortunately, not.
Okay. Denise Belleville, you mentioned in the Wall Street Journal this month that at least two home health care agencies in South Florida have shut down after losing some 80 workers who had TPS, but we're also seeing an impact on nonprofits like Jewish Community Services of South Florida, which helps hundreds of Holocaust survivors get in-home care here. What is the elder care and disabled care landscape looking like right now as a result of this, would you say?
I think what unfortunately happens is when you don't, when we have such a caregiver crisis that we have, and then you lose such a percentage of your staff, then those patients, those clients who live at home, because they do have someone to take care of them, now have to go to a higher level of care. So you think about the additional cost to an ALF or to a nursing home,
I'm sorry, an ALF
assisted living facility.
facility, right? Okay, just.
That's what would have to happen is they need to have someone there, and that would cause that individual to have to age in another place than they didn't plan.
Right. Now, you mentioned two home health care agencies that have had to shut down because of the loss of these workers. Are you expecting more to be facing that same situation in the coming weeks and months?
I don't know that I could answer that clearly. We've certainly heard from other providers who are concerned specifically about, yes, the TPS for Haiti, but they are more concerned that they have other staff that are from other countries that are also here on a protected status.
Right. Venezuelans, for example.
So they are genuinely concerned about every one of their staff that is here in another status other than born in the US of A.
All right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Denise Belleville and Kyle Simon of the Home Care Association of Florida about the home health care staffing crisis here resulting from the Haitian TPS crisis. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Kyle Simon, I think one question a lot of folks have is why Haitians came to represent such a large swath of the workforce in home health care and related sectors in Florida. How did this come about over the years, especially since 2010, the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, which was the reason the U.S. granted Haitians here TPS to begin with?
One of the drivers is the growing demand for in-home care. COVID certainly exacerbated that, and we are certainly we were try we would love to have more American workers in our sector. That's but unfortunately that has not come to fruition. So obviously Haitians have been able to get employment in the hospitality sector and in healthcare, and we value the backbreaking work that they do every day. So I
Was it was it a, was one factor were you finding as you, was your organization finding, for example, that a lot of the Haitian TPS holders who were here perhaps had some skill developed back in Haiti that sort of dovetailed perhaps or made it easier for them to step into home healthcare role here?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Not the Haitian TPS holders who work in the healthcare sector are not just direct care workers, home health aides, for example. But there are nurses, there are therapists who, yes, back in Haiti, they were practicing it, that was their profession. So it absolutely fits like a glove coming over here, and the need in healthcare across the nation is severe.
I spoke this week in North Miami with a woman who's losing TPS but had gained her ABA certification here and was working with children with disabilities before she had to give that up because her TPS work authorization had ended, obviously. Is there any other sort of immigration status path that organizations like yours can help convince the government to grant them so that they can remain here and do that kind of work here?
There was legislation that passed in the Congress, I'm sorry, in the House of Representatives, not in the Senate,
Right.
that would have created a pathway. Unfortunately, the Senate has not taken that up. And there was also legislation a few years back that was the Citizenship for Essential Workers Act at the federal level that would have created pathways for immigrants who work in essential fields such as healthcare. But unfortunately, that didn't pass either. So we've advocated in support of that, steering clear of the politics, simply being that if we want to allow Americans to age in place and age in the most cost-effective setting, receiving high-quality care at home, then we need more boots on the ground.
Denise Belleville, what then can the home healthcare industry do moving forward to make up for the worker loss and shortage crisis you're facing now as Haitian TPS holders lose their work authorization?
You know, some things that the state of Florida have done the last two sessions have added money to a fund to help raise new RNs
RNs being registered nurses.
being registered nurses. And that will help. That will help to input some education, you know, educated staff, although you have to know that's still four years in the making, right? It's 4 years until we get that. You know, I think one of the other things we've continued to fight for is the reimbursement for Medicaid specifically and for the managed care organizations to the home care industry, because the home care industry in the state of Florida, we rank number 50 for pay for our RNs, LPNs, and caregivers like a home health aide in the home. So when you rank number 50, and you have all the competing items that you have, whether that's fast food, you know, Amazon to take your staff away, that creates another challenge. Although I do have to tell you know, the rural health transformation, the money that was set aside in the state of Florida, which includes some zip codes in the Miami-Dade County, did have a push for education specifically for home care workers. So we look forward to a growth of those workers through that, through the rural health transformation over these few years, that there's an infusion of that money into the community. It won't be enough to make up for what our shortage is now, and then to add on the workers that you're going to lose.
Right. And Kyle, you would agree that the state needs to do more to sort of fill that wage salary gap that seems to be a big factor here then in getting new people into these positions.
Absolutely. There was a report a few years ago from Florida Tax Watch, actually, that said
Right.
the state increasing their investments in home and community-based services could save up to $745 million annually. So there certainly needs to be an increase in the Medicaid reimbursement rate, as Denise mentioned.
We'll have to leave it there. Kyle Simon is Senior Policy Director. Denise Belleville is Executive Director of the Home Care Association of Florida. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you for
Thanks
having me.
so much.
Finally, on the roundup, this week, as you know, we lost an American legend when country music star and humanitarian Dolly Parton died Tuesday at the age of 80.
We both know that I'm not what you need.
In Dolly's honor, the iconic Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Hollywood lit up the facade of its Guitar Hotel with her signature butterflies. Parton performed at the Hard Rock 15 years ago, and her robe is still on display at the hotel. Parton also played several shows at the Miami-Dade County Fair in the 1970s and 80s. And of course, there's this coincidence this week. A tropical storm has formed in the Atlantic, heading in our general direction. Its name? Dolly. This week's South Florida Roundup is over, my friends. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Chris Young. Denise Royal is the senior producer of content streaming and news products. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mears. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.